This dark mass, murmuring words incomprehensible to my ear, was moving through Vienna toward the promised land.
Dr. Palisar, in this final lecture, we're going to study some of the legacy that Herzl leaves for us. How did he die?
Herzl died of, essentially, of heart failure. He almost certainly hastened his own death by the insane working hours that he put in, by having taken the weight of the world, or at least the Jewish world, on his shoulders. Died in 1904 while hoping to recuperate.
And at the moment of his death, was he still the regnant leader of the movement that he'd worked so hard throughout his whole life to found? Had controversies ridden up? What was the situation within the Zionist institutions at the moment that he passed away?
So when he passed away, he remained the leader of the Zionist movement. He had been damaged in the controversy over Uganda. He'd been damaged somewhat by criticisms of his utopian novel, Altneuland, but he was the man. He was it. There wasn't any logical person to replace him. There wasn't anybody of significance who was really challenging him for the leadership. They were arguing over the policies within a movement that very much remained Herzl's movement. And in fact, it took quite some time before a successor was appointed, because there was almost the sense that no one is worthy, there's no one else who can step into those shoes. And as if Herzl, imagining for a moment if he had had a miraculous recovery, he would have gone on to lead the Zionist movement. I don't know for how long, because everybody's replaceable and it's difficult for a leader to last in difficult circumstances forever. But no, he remained the leading figure diplomatically, the leading figure in his intellectual defense of an advancement of Zionism, and the leading figure in terms of the institution building. And by the way, if you clocked hours per year worked, he probably worked more for the Zionist movement during every year in the last 8 years of his life, more than anyone else.
Who are some of the most prominent, important people who followed Herzl, were inspired by Herzl after he passed away?
So, first of all, Herzl is buried in Vienna, and there are beautiful, beautiful descriptions of this funeral in which thousands of Jews coming from around the world came to pay their respects to him. And Stefan Zweig, among others, writes that only in this moment could you realize that the person who was being laid to rest was not just another intellectual, not just another political figure, not just another would-be leader, but this was a man who truly had led his people. So there was this general outpouring, but people who in very great ways were influenced by Herzl: David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister of the State of Israel; Zev Jabotinsky, the leader of what became the revisionist movement, the more right-leaning side within the Zionist movement. Chaim Weizmann himself was significantly affected by Herzl, even though he was at times in opposition to Herzl. Nachum Sokolov, who, according to my friend and colleague Martin Kramer, is the person who gets the most immediate credit for the Balfour Declaration, was influenced by Herzl. David Lloyd George was influenced by Herzl, the prime minister at the time of the Balfour Declaration. Herzl had a profound impact. It's not an accident that when David Ben-Gurion declared the Jewish state, the State of Israel, on May 14, 1948, there was exactly one portrait above him, and that portrait had exactly one man, Theodor Herzl. He was unlike anyone else. What made Herzl unique, certainly within the Zionist movement, but more broadly, if you look at nationalist movements over the last couple of centuries, is he did it all. He was the leading writer for his movement, the leading writer and thinker for his movement. He was the leading institution builder and runner of those institutions and the very institutions that ultimately brought about the state. He was the leading diplomat who paved the way for the greatest successes later on. You don't find that, an individual who's able to do all three of those things. And the fact that he did all of that within 9 years, having come from a background in which he was not born into royalty, in which he did not have a political background, but came really from being a journalist and a playwright to the nationalist leader, it's utterly extraordinary.
Some of the men that you named disagreed with one another in profound ways, and that they both saw Herzl as an inspiration and figure that they were themselves learned from, says something about the capacity within the man, that Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion both admired him.
Well, Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion had a great deal in common. They loved the Jewish people. They were deeply, deeply pained by offenses to Jewish honor, and even more so by offenses to Jewish property and lives. They were both men of boldness, of great action, of decisiveness. And they saw those traits in Herzl, and to a certain extent, they learned those traits from their own study of Herzl. It's true, they disagreed on certain issues, but Herzl really spoke to those elements that were absolutely essential. We must have sovereignty. We must be able to defend ourselves. We must secure a charter with agreement internationally. We must ultimately build up this land. We have the ability to do something really great here, right? Herzl articulated those things. He believed them from the very core of his existence. And Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky both believed those things and acted each in his own ways to bring them about. It seems like the most natural thing in the world that, of course, they were impacted by Herzl. We met Theodor Herzl together on June 2nd, 1895, the day he launched his career as a Zionist leader in his meeting with Baron Hirsch. And over the course of these last six lectures, we first laid out the intellectual challenges, the challenges of persuasion that he had to deal with, the institution-building challenges, and the diplomatic challenges that he had to face. And seeing how much there was that needed to be done, we then gained an appreciation of Herzl. And after looking at his biography, at least in brief, we took a much closer examination of his Jewish attitudes, of the education and experiences that he brought to the table, of his fundamental character traits, and of certain other assets that he had as a Zionist figure that perhaps others wouldn't have had. And once we were armed with the sense of a challenge and the sense of the man who was facing that challenge, we then looked at how he addressed it. First on the intellectual side, through the publication of the Jewish state, Der Judenstaat, in February of 1896, and its translation into multiple languages, and the massive campaign to get those ideas out to persuade Jews that a Jewish state was both desirable and feasible. From there, we considered the strategic issues that he faced, the dilemma he faced, where he ultimately decided that the second key step was institution building, and that he was going to do it through convening this very risky, bet-the-whole-farm International Zionist Congress. And we saw that that overall worked both in the conceptualization and also in the way that it was achieved, so that when it was over, he said with some justification, "In Basel I founded the Jewish state." And finally, in our last lecture, we looked at the way that he was able to act diplomatically without a lot of assets, without a lot of things that he could give, and without a lot of allies among the big powers. And he tried everything. Most things didn't work so well. He made progress, though, in pretty much every front. And his greatest defeat was perhaps his greatest victory. His greatest defeat was the Uganda Plan, gained by negotiations with the British Empire and accepted, but really in the end rejected by the Zionist movement. And that could have been the end of it, except that he laid the path through those negotiations, through the allies he and his loyal lieutenants made in Great Britain, in the British Empire, for what ended up happening in the Balfour Declaration that was 14 years later, that truly paved the way for a national homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. So We've been with Herzl through thick and thin over these last six lectures, and now it's time to say goodbye. It's time to say goodbye to Herzl because not long after the Uganda discussion at the Sixth Zionist Congress in August of 1903, his health, long tenuous, began to fail even more. And we find him in July of 1904 at a resort not far from Vienna, trying unsuccessfully to recuperate, not only so that he can go on and live another day, but so that he can resume the activities that for him had been all-consuming over this course of these whirlwind 9 years. His last will and testament was that he should be buried in Vienna, and as befits a good son, a man of true filial piety, he wanted to be buried next to his father in the same place that his mother would be buried. In fact, more or less his last wish, the thing for which he clung to life at the end, was he wanted to stay alive to say goodbye to his mother. He also asked that when the State of Israel was founded, when the Jewish state was founded, he wanted to be reburied there, and he wanted to be reburied there together with his parents and together with his family. His funeral took place on July 7th of 1904, and it was described by the author Stefan Zweig, who had been something of a protege of Herzl in an earlier stage when Zweig was writing Feuilleton, writing this special form of essay, and it was just instinctive to him that, of course, the first place he would go to get a piece published once he was ready with something that he thought was of true quality was to the Neue Freie Presse and to its editor of that section, Theodor Herzl. And over the years, he stayed in touch with Herzl, but not as much as either of them had wanted to. And this is how Stefan Zweig describes that day. It was a singular day, a day in July, unforgettable to those who participated in the experience. Suddenly, to all the railroad stations of the city, by day and by night, from all realms and lands, every train brought new arrivals. Western, Eastern, Russian, Turkish Jews. From all the provinces and all the little towns, they hurried excitedly, the shock of the news still written on their faces. Never was it more clearly manifest what strife and talk had hitherto concealed. It was a great movement whose leader had now fallen. The procession was endless. Vienna, startled, became aware that it was not just a writer or a mediocre poet who had passed away, but one of those creators of ideas who disclose themselves triumphantly in a single country to a single people at vast intervals. A tumult ensued at the cemetery. Too many had suddenly stormed to his coffin, crying, sobbing, screaming in a wild explosion of despair. It was almost a riot, a fury. All regulation was upset through a sort of elementary and ecstatic mourning, such as I had never seen before nor since at a funeral. This is Stefan Zweig writing memoirs many decades later, 4 decades later. And it was this gigantic outpouring of grief from the depths of millions of souls that made me realize for the first time how much passion and hope this lone and lonesome man had born into the world through the power of a single thought. What we're going to do in this last lecture to sum up what this lone and lonesome man had born into the world through the power of a single thought is, first of all, assess Herzl's accomplishments as a Zionist leader. Second, I want to look at those accomplishments in comparative perspective to see what we might be able to learn from the examples of other countries and what others perhaps might be able to learn from the example of Herzl in terms of nation building. And third and finally, I want to examine some of the most outstanding traits that Herzl showed across time as a leader during these 9 years that are worth our understanding to appreciate him, and for anyone interested in leadership, worth looking at to see whether we might be able to embody some of these same traits. We'll begin with Herzl's accomplishments as a Zionist leader. And the first thing you have to understand is, what was the state of play for the idea of creating a Jewish state when Herzl came on the scene in June of 1895? The answer is it was incredibly remote. One of the least talked about, least likely scenarios, developments that one could possibly have imagined. There were, apart from a few tens of thousands of Jews in Europe and fewer still in Palestine, there were not Jews who were actively pursuing this goal. Not only that, but outside of very small Christian restorationist circles in the US and Britain, to a lesser extent in the German Empire, this was not on the agenda of significant world powers or of the people populating those significant world powers. There had been a movement aimed at founding a Jewish state called Chibat Zion, and it had started about 15 years before Herzl launched Zionism with Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. But that movement, Chibat Zion, never attained great power, never attained great numbers, and by the end of the 19th century, whatever momentum it had, had slowed even more. It didn't have the money, it didn't have the manpower, it didn't have the political clout, it didn't have the institutions, it didn't have any of the big ingredients for building a state. That was the situation when Herzl came on the scene. By the time of his death, 9 years later, Zionism was a burgeoning movement. There were more than 100,000 Jews, considerably more, who on one level or another were engaged in this movement, and far more who were talking about it, reading about it, aware of it. It was a real presence. Not only that, but the Zionist movement had strong institutions. It had its Zionist congresses, it had its executive, it had its funds, it had its bank. It had democratic elections for the Congress. It had a tradition. It had hundreds and hundreds of chapters around the world that participated in the movement and that sought to energize locals to get involved with it. But not only were there institutions, there was also a future leadership there, whether that was in the form of Herzl's closest colleague and disciple, David Wolfson, or whether it was in the form of Chaim Weizmann, who of course would go on to do great things in the Balfour Declaration and otherwise, or Nachum Sokolov, or a still young but deeply influenced David Ben-Gurion, or a host of other people who became Zionists through Herzl, who joined the movement because of Herzl, whose ideas were formed in large part by reading Der Judenstaat and later things that Herzl wrote and hearing his words. There was an entire movement that was here, but not only that. The idea of a Jewish state was known throughout the greatest powers in the world, and one of those powers, the British Empire, had already come around through its leadership to the idea of helping to build a Jewish homeland. And it was that selfsame British Empire that was to do so only a decade and a half after Herzl passed from the world. So Herzl actually had founded the Jewish state in Basel. He was right in what he wrote in September of 1897. Not only in the sense that he wrote about it, that he had given the people who were there and through them the Jewish people around the world that subjective sense which is the basis of nationhood, that they are a nation, that they are a people, that they are rising up, that they belong to one another, and that they have the power to act in history and bring their nation back onto the map and back into world history. So he had done that, but he had also set up the selfsame institutions that if you look back at what happened from 1904 through until 1948, it was largely the institutions that Herzl built that created the Jewish state. And it was, to a very large extent, the people whom he had brought into the movement and energized who led those institutions and did the bold acts that brought about the Jewish state. And it was his diplomatic path with the British Empire that led to the Balfour Declaration. So he really had founded the Jewish state, not only in Basel, but in what he did before Basel and what he did after Basel. I think without Herzl, it's very hard to imagine any of these things happening. And in fact, I think it would be extremely difficult to make the case that there could have been a Jewish state without Herzl. Because if the Zionist movement had not arisen when it did, and if the leaders who joined it had not joined it at the time that they did, and if there hadn't been negotiations with the British Empire at that point, well, something would have happened in 1917 when Allenby entered Palestine with his troops and it became British responsibility. But it is very, very unlikely that that something would have been a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland or anything approaching it. And in fact, it almost certainly would have been some arrangement for what would happen with that territory that would have precluded for the foreseeable, by which I mean the indefinite future, the prospect of a Jewish state. So, very simple. No Herzl, no Jewish state. You can say that about very few people in the history of Zionism. I'm comfortable making that case about David Ben-Gurion. I think a case like that could be made, but more disputably, with respect to Chaim Weizmann, and perhaps with respect to President Harry Truman, and the list ends there. But the person who's at the top of the list, the one who unequivocally, without him there is no Jewish state, is Theodor Herzl. That's on what he accomplished as a Zionist leader. I want to look at Herzl now in comparative perspective. Right? I'm not going to pretend he's the only great founder of a state in the modern period, and I won't say that he's the only person who was able to do more than one thing. There are other people who are great writers and also great military figures, or were diplomats and also built institutions, and all of us are familiar with examples of these. But what Herzl did that, to my knowledge, was unique was in the three areas that were most essential. It wasn't that he was one of the players in the Zionist movement. He was the absolute dominant figure and the person who brought about success. He was the leader in the realm of ideas when there was a huge intellectual challenge to persuade people that a Jewish state was both desirable and feasible. He was by far the overwhelming force in creating the institutions that were absolutely essential to bringing about the Jewish state, and not only creating those institutions, but running them for enough years to create a tradition that others were able to follow in afterwards. And he was overwhelmingly the chief diplomat. Now, in all of these areas, he had colleagues, he had lieutenants, he had people who followed him, he had people who did great things, but he was the dominant figure in all of these, and I think it would be very, very hard to find anyone else in the modern period of founding nations who was responsible for the three most essential areas. You know, that triple, the three, reminds any of us who have the United States in our background of the famous eulogy by Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee about George Washington, whom he referred to as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. True enough, but when we think back about the founding of the United States, we think about either the founding fathers, or perhaps in the even more appropriate term used by the historian Joseph Ellis, the founding brothers. Right? George Washington was not the great writer of the movement. Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, perhaps others deserve that distinction. George Washington was not the great diplomat at a time when relations with France and with Great Britain were paramount. That role was played by people like Adams, Franklin, Jay. Washington wasn't really the great institution builder, although he played a significant role. That was done by especially Hamilton and Madison. So if we take that example, we see that usually the leadership role is split. And think about any other country where you personally have a familiarity with how nationalism was built up there, how the nation was formed. It can be Italy, it can be Ireland, it can be Greece. Take your pick. There are many to choose from. You will usually find a set of people, at least a pair, three, five, ten, who divide among them the key roles. Herzl, I think, was unique in the history of modern nationalism because he really did it all at a time when doing it all was absolutely essential. I want to talk, though, as the third and final element of what I'm doing in this lecture, I want to talk about what made Herzl such a great leader. I spoke in the second lecture about some of the things that were already in his biography and that we could already see at the moment that he was meeting with Baron Hirsch in June of 1895. But what I want to do now is look at these 9 years of leadership and try to distill the things that were, first of all, essential, and second, are things that might possibly be learned. It's true that Herzl was in many ways a genius, but it's hard to learn how to be a genius if you're looking for lessons in leadership. And it's true that Herzl had a tremendously expressive pair of eyes and this deeply, deeply distinguished beard, but you know, it's hard to learn those kinds, how to develop those kinds of physical characteristics, or even to develop the kind of presence that he had, the kind of magnetism that he had. But he did, I think, 5 things that were essential, each one of them to his leadership, and of value to anybody looking at history to understand leadership, or those who have an applied bent. It's valuable to figure out how anyone trying to be a leader might be even better at it. And the first one was he found something about which to be obsessed. In fact, he didn't find it. It found him. He was obsessed with Jewish honor, with the sense that the Jews had been put in a situation that was absolutely intolerable. David Vital, who wrote a, I think, superb 3-volume history of the beginnings of Zionism, wrote about Herzl in the first of those, called The Origins of Zionism, as follows. The delivery of the Jews from shame and bondage obsessed Herzl. He knew he was obsessed. He recognized the obsession as a source of strength, and it seems he took a keen delight in it. And if you look back at everything that we have spoken about in these lectures, you see that obsession. It's consuming him as he's writing those slips of paper in morning and night and walking and while doing his day job and interrupted and wherever he was absolutely obsessed writing ideas that would end up finding their way into Der Judenstaat, into the Jewish state. And then when the book came out, he was obsessed with making sure that it would be read, and he was obsessed with meeting with anybody who could do something about it. And after that, people who were familiar with, involved in the preparations for the Zionist Congress, described the way Herzl was absolutely obsessed about this. And he was obsessed about it because he was obsessed about this great problem of what had happened to the Jews, the Jewish question, as he wrote about so poignantly in the second chapter of The Jewish State, and as he lived his life in the last decade in order to try to right that wrong. So lesson number one for leaders is there has to be something that you're deeply disturbed about. Now, maybe you can find out there an exception or two, but generally when you find a great leader, there was something that angered him, something that made him feel terrible, something that he just had to correct. He couldn't continue in the world if this problem existed, if something wasn't done to fix this. Great leaders find their this. Great leaders find that thing that stirs them to action, and Herzl did, and without that, he couldn't have been who he was, and he couldn't have done what he did. But there's a second side to that obsession, because a great leader can't just be motivated by that sense of shame or by that hatred or by something terrible in the world. There has to be something that the great leader is drawn towards and that he wants to bring into the world and bring others so that they enjoy the benefits of it. And the person who I think phrased this perhaps better than anyone else is an unlikely candidate, I think, to have spoken beautiful words about Herzl. You might recall from our discussion about Herzl's pride as a Jew that he was a member of the Albia Dueling Fraternity at the University of Vienna. And he was a proud member, and he spent hundreds and hundreds of hours learning how to use a saber, learning how to duel, and in fact, dueling. And yet, like that, very, very quickly, in a certain moment, he resigned. And he resigned because a junior member of the fraternity, Hermann Bar, had Hermann Bahr had given a speech, a rousing speech, at a memorial event for the great but greatly anti-Semitic composer Richard Wagner. And the police ended up intervening, and Bahr became something of a hero because he had identified with Wagner and with Wagner's pan-Germanism, and many people say he identified with Wagner's anti-Semitism. And this led Herzl to resign from Albia because it wasn't condemned, and Bahr was a representative of Albia speaking there in his official capacity. Well, wouldn't you know it, the years go on, they become friends. Bahr becomes a novelist, a playwright, a literary critic, and an editor. And here's what he writes about Herzl. "There was a time when our work threw us into intimate contact. On fine summer evenings, he would stop at my office on his way out and ask me whether I cared to walk a little of the way with him. But our walk sometimes lasted for hours. We kept on circling the votive church of Vienna until the sun had set and the twilight was dying. And perpetually he returned to the theme that had made him its prisoner. Again and again he repeated, 'There is no nation without a country. What is more, there is no man without a country.' He may not know it. He may not feel the slightest desire to know it. He may feel perfectly at home in a strange land, but he must know that somewhere in the world there is a country predestined to be his own and that of his family, a country which must permit him to enter, which cannot refuse him. He does not dream of going to his country. He has no desire to do so. But he knows that there is a country that is waiting for him, that belongs to him and to which he belongs. No man can live without this." Herzl not only was focused on anti-Semitism, but he believed very, very deeply in the potentials of creating a country for the Jewish people. That's why, in the conclusion of the Jewish state, he writes about a new generation of Maccabeans shall arise again. That's why he writes in his poignant essay, The Menorah, about his own return to Judaism. That's why, scattered throughout the Jewish state and through his other writings, you can see evidence that this was a man who believed that the Jewish state would bring glory and honor to those people who had the courage to become a part of it, and that it would redound to the benefit of the world, and that it was something that was not just a way to solve the problem of anti-Semitism, but a way to bring really, really great things to Jews as individuals, to Jews as a nation, and to the world more generally. So yes, Herzl had the obsession about the thing he couldn't stand, but he also had an obsession about the thing that he wanted to bring into the world. And if you think about other great leaders, they tend to share this. I'll mention only one, Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill was a man obsessed with the dangers and the evils of fascism and of Nazism from early in the 1930s, deeply obsessed for a decade. And when he came to power in May of 1940, he was focused singularly on defeating the menace of Nazi Germany. But what did he do during the 1930s, other than give endless speeches warning about Hitler and about Nazism? He wrote a great history of the English-speaking peoples. And he did that in part because he wanted to remind himself, what was the goal? What was the beautiful thing that he wanted to sustain? Right? It's not just that there's an enemy, but there's something that we think is glorious, something that we as a people think is worth living for, something that we want to make as enduring as possible. And so what made Churchill such a great wartime leader, among other things, is yes, he had an enemy, but at the same time, he deeply, deeply loved the British Empire. He deeply loved his people. He loved the free world. He understood why they were so essential for everything he cared about. And I use that as an example because Herzl, I think, embodies this so well. And whenever you look at somebody who's a truly great leader, look for the thing that he couldn't stand having in the world, and the thing that he really believed in deeply and wanted to make sure that it was there and sustained. The third thing, Herzl laid out his goal with remarkable clarity. It's there in the headline of Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. No subtlety whatsoever. He lays it out there, and then he puts it in the preface, and he puts it in the introduction, and he puts it in the second chapter, and he puts it in the conclusion. The goal is a Jewish state. And even when he needed to be a little bit more diplomatic in his language, still he laid out a very, very clear goal. What did he say at that first Zionist Congress? Early on in his remarks, which opened the Congress, "We want to lay the foundation stone for the home that is destined to be the haven for the Jewish people." What did he insist had to be part of the Basel program that was adopted at the end of those 3 days? A very clear sentence. "Zionism seeks to establish a home for the Jewish people in Palestine, secured under public law." Great leaders find a way to get their idea across very clearly, very succinctly, very directly. If we again use the Churchill example so that it's clear this is not just about Herzl, this is about what great leaders do. If you listen to the first public address that Churchill gave after he assumed the prime ministership of Great Britain, and he says, "You ask me what is our aim?" And he speaks about victory. Victory at all costs. We need to win. There's no subtlety. There's one goal, and he wants everybody to know the goal is victory, and victory is achievable. And that was Herzl. There is but one goal. It's to lay the foundation stone for the Jewish state, and that goal is achievable. Some might say, we need more subtlety. We need the ability to see the grays. We need to understand the sophistication and the complexity. But the truly great leader can see beyond that complexity and can formulate that one powerful idea, that one lever, that fulcrum, that point, that statement backed by bold action, which is going to inspire people to do the great deed that needs to be done. Fourth, Herzl had an unbelievable work ethic. He, while holding down a full-time, very responsible, high-profile job at the Neue Freie Presse as an editor, worked more during those 9 years to bring about the Zionist vision than anyone else worked during those 9 years, and probably as much as anybody worked during any 9-year period before the foundation of the state. And if he had slept just a little bit more and done just a little bit less, then who knows whether he would have succeeded. Because leadership is not just about the great speech, the great writing, the great act in a war. Typically, when your goal is a bold and important one, involved in that leadership is a need for a combination of sprints, those manic bursts of 10 days or a few weeks where you're just completely preoccupied with writing something or bringing about a Congress or negotiating with the British. Those sprints are mixed with marathons where you're just at it time after time, another meeting, this one with a representative of the Pope, this one with a representative of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, this one with a controversial figure in the Russian Empire, this one with somebody who might become part of the future leadership of the Zionist movement. And it was by putting in that extraordinary 24/7 work over 9 years that Herzl was able to achieve what he achieved. And you know what? Look at other great leaders. Look at Abraham Lincoln during the American Civil War. Look at Churchill in his wartime leadership. Look at any example that you know well of somebody who had a goal that required sustained effort, and you'll see an extraordinary work ethic. And the fifth and final element of Herzl's leadership is he learned. He learned all the time. If you think about what he knew and what he didn't know as of June 1895, it's extraordinary what he achieved. Up until then, he hadn't written books, or he hadn't written sustained arguments, and he he had written plays, he had written other things, but he had never written anything programmatic. He learned how to write something programmatic and powerful as part of the process of penning the Jewish state. He was out of practice as a speaker and had never liked really to speak in front of the large audiences, even when he was part of that literary and cultural society in the university. Well, he became a man who would speak readily, impromptu, in a variety of languages, in front of audiences of thousands and thousands of people, and with hundreds of thousands ready to read those words when they went into print later. So even in the area where he was strong, as the intellectual area, he's a man who learned. Institution building, well, the last time he had founded an institution, as far as I know, was in his early teens when he founded a literary society for himself and his friends and became the president of it. Fast forward two decades, he's been mostly a cultural figure, writing, not having to supervise people, not having to build something. He learns very quickly how to found an institution, how to build organizations within it, how to create a tradition, how to run that institution, how to people that institution, learned in a field that he knew very, very little about. And finally, diplomacy. What did he know of how to navigate your way through the Sultan's court, of how to find your way to the Kaiser, of how to find allies in the most unlikely places in order to get yourself into conversations with the highest echelons in the British Empire? He knew nothing of these things other than that he watched politicians in one country, France, not even the major power in Europe at that point. He watched them, so he learned from the outside about politics, but doing it from the inside, actually being a diplomat, a practitioner, completely different. If Herzl in 1904 didn't know a lot more than what he had known in 1895, he would not have been the leader of the Zionist movement, and that movement could not have been successful. So what the great leaders do, pretty much all of them, is they realize that the big challenges require you not only to do things you haven't done, but to learn things, to know things, to develop skills in areas you hadn't perhaps even dreamed of before. And whether you're looking at Ben-Gurion, as he learned about defense affairs in the years leading up to the founding of the state, or whether you're looking at Lincoln learning about military affairs, or whether you're looking at leaders learning about different segments of their population that are at odds with each other and whose culture and values need to be appreciated in order to sew the fabric back together, the great leaders learn all the time. They're outside their comfort zone, and they know that they have to continue learning because the real challenges are the ones that are outside your comfort zone that require you to know things you didn't know and do things that you didn't do. So Herzl really founded the Jewish state. And it's only appropriate that at the founding moment of that state, when David Ben-Gurion in Tel Aviv is reading out the Declaration of Independence, there's exactly one picture above him, one portrait of exactly one man, Theodor Herzl, who together with Ben-Gurion and others had really founded that Jewish state. A year later, it was entirely fitting that Herzl's body, his remains, was brought to Israel, to Jerusalem, which was being advanced on the Jewish side as the capital of that state, to that same Jerusalem that Herzl hadn't liked so much in its real form in 1898, but had dreamed of making it a much better and more beautiful place. It's only fitting that Herzl came and was a part not only of Israel physically, but came as a part of Jerusalem. And it was fitting because he had shown the way. And again, ironically enough, it was the person whose speech had pushed him out of Albia, who had forced him to take a stand as a proud Jew, who put this best, right? Because Hermann Bar, also attended the funeral. And this is what he wrote. "It was only at Herzl's funeral that I began to understand fully just what he meant. The procession lasted for hours. I went with it, and I realized that I was in an alien world. This dark mass, murmuring words incomprehensible to my ear, was moving through Vienna toward the promised land. And Herzl's achievement is this. He restored to his people the knowledge of their home. And he did. He restored the knowledge. He restored the dream. He showed them the way institutionally. He showed them the way diplomatically. He became the indispensable figure, a man worth learning about as a human being, as a leader, as a great Zionist, and as someone who achieved that which at the time seemed virtually inconceivable. Thank you.
What would you say is the legacy of Herzl in the State of Israel today?
Most profoundly, the legacy of Herzl in the State of Israel today is the State of Israel. The fact that we are in Israel, the fact that I live in Israel with my wife and my six children and my granddaughter, the fact that there is a State of Israel today, that's because of Theodor Herzl. There's, if God forbid, at the moment that he was about to publish the Jewish state, there was a fire in his home, the manuscript disappeared, and the man perished in the fire. It is very difficult to imagine that there would have been a Jewish state, because there wasn't anybody else doing anything like what he was doing in the intellectual spade work, or thinking already about building the institutions, or conceptualizing the diplomacy. We now know that there was a narrow window of 2 decades between the time that Herzl put out the Jewish state in February of 1896, and the time when the future of Palestine was being discussed within and among the great powers towards the end of World War I, 1916, 1917. If it weren't for Herzl and the fact that he wrote that book, convened that Congress, conducted those negotiations, put the Jewish people on the world map, and paved the way for them being real powerful claimants to this land, it's virtually inconceivable that there would have been a Balfour Declaration in 1917 saying that His Majesty's government looks with favor upon the creation of a homeland for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Right? So if it hadn't been a Balfour Declaration, it would have been something else. Some other people would have been assigned this land, and the chance for a Jewish state, at least within the land of Israel, would have been lost probably forever. And if we hadn't gotten a state in the land of Israel, the idea that we would have somehow solved this problem in Argentina or Uganda, in retrospect, seems, let's just call it, quite unlikely. And so, no, the legacy of Herzl in the State of Israel is the fact that we have the State of Israel. There are legacies beyond that. Herzl was very much a liberal in much of his thinking, and there's a liberal streak within Israel. Herzl was somebody who believed very profoundly that we had to create great things, that the Jews were capable of greatness and of being an or goyim, a light unto the nations, and I think Israel to a very large extent has achieved that. But I wouldn't want to get away from the central thing. Without this man, without this extraordinary leadership, without him doing something that no other nationalist leader had done, really taking it all on and succeeding in all of it, there wouldn't be an Israel today. He truly was a figure who moved history exactly as he hoped he would be, and exactly as his parents had this dream that perhaps he could be.